It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 217, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, saved by a car app. 4-hour work week, Apple Vision Pro still great.
Hey, Gary, how's it going?
Good, Leo. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's actually sunny outside. I have to enjoy that a little while later.
Yeah, we got a storm coming later this week, so our winter's not over yet.
We had quite the storm over the weekend. Lots of branches down and, you know, power interruptions, that kind of stuff. But we survived.
Yeah.
So the first thing I came up with this week, it dawned on me this morning, actually, that I wonder, you know, what had happened to the latest crew that was going to be sent up to the International Space Station. Mm-hmm. I remember last week I was kind of looking at the SpaceX site to see, you know, when it was going to go. And I think there was a delay or something involved at one point. And then I didn't hear anything. And come to find out this morning that not only did they take off, I think it was on the 3rd, but the crew that came back already came back on the 11th, yesterday, as it turns out. And what just amazed me, the reason that I mentioned it at all is that I never saw anything about this on the news.
Right. Yeah, me too.
At all. I mean, you know, obviously those people that are proactively looking for the information will find it, as usual. But, you know, if you're like grabbing your newspaper or looking at any of the online news sites, it's just not there. And what I guess what that means is that it's no longer newsworthy. It's routine. And, you know, obviously for someone that grew up when I did, and I suspect it applies somewhat to you as well, spaceflight was a big deal.
Sure. Yeah. There were even things, if you take the time to look, like, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but the crew that just came back, there were 4 crew members from 4 different countries.
Well, I did notice the countries. Yeah. Yeah. You're probably right. Yeah.
And I noticed, if you look on like the, you know, the space news part of the internet where people do care about it, people were talking about how unusual that was and may actually be, you know, depending how you divide the crews up, may actually have been the first time, but it was a truly international crew 7 that came back. So, very little mention of that anywhere.
What's funny is that, you know, we also kind of sort of talk casually, it's crew 7 who's being replaced by crew 8.
Yeah.
You know, that's a bunch of people that have been ferried up and down there.
Which is not even, that's, the numbers are starting with the SpaceX launches. Is that?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, because obviously not crew 8 of the International Space Station.
No.
It's way higher number than that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Hmm.
Anyway, I just thought that was amazing. That this has become so routine. Now, I'm hoping I'm not jinxing anything, right? I mean, I'm still in the mode of, you know, oh gosh, I hope something doesn't explode someday, because there's always a non-zero chance of that happening.
Yeah.
I just think it's really impressive that they've pulled off this much over this time. And like I said, it's just another space flight.
Yep. Yeah, it's happening more often. More countries are able to do it, or private companies in some cases. And hopefully setting the stage for, you know, because we've got these moon, Mars and the moon, you know, both are on the radar of multiple countries. And it's hopefully this is like the period where things are, you know, the technology is coming in. And these, the launch capability, you know, which isn't as exciting for the headlines, is getting better and better. And so we're about to, at some point, move forward and start having, you know, return to the moon and then the first mission to Mars, you know, in the future soon. but the groundwork is being laid now. You know, it's like this is kind of the, you know, the uneventful groundwork where we can easily send people up into orbit and large payloads up into orbit and check those boxes for those future more exciting missions.
I do have to say that, you know, dovetailing on the last episode, it would be nice if we could land something on the moon, not sideways.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it seems like when we have a human on board, we have no problem. It's sending the robots. I think there are some reasons for that. I mean, part of it is no atmosphere, you know, which is different than Mars. The aerodynamics of landing don't exist.
Exactly. There are no aerodynamics. Yes.
So you're landing something on a body that has a substantial amount of gravity. We don't think of it like that, but the moon is a large body compared to, say, asteroids, comets, other things, or just docking with the space station, right? This is a large body. It's got gravity. It's got a surface. It's got a tricky surface that's not necessarily flat, right? We take it for granted on Earth here that erosion, water and wind and such, has created lots of flat areas. And when you don't have water and wind to erode things in the same way, you only have gravity, which does do some erosion. You don't have those flat areas. You have dusty and rocky and areas that are not level, that kind of thing. So it's a very different thing than landing something on Mars, where you did have erosion, you do have flat areas, and you do have aerodynamics to help. I mean, remember, when we land something on Mars, parachutes deploy.
Exactly. I was thinking the same thing. Yeah. Investors not an option on the moon.
Nope. You can't. No. Parachutes are not something that are usable. You have to slow down using actual propulsion. So anyway, yeah, there are interesting reasons behind it. It's fascinating to read about. So,
what's new with you?
Well, let's see. I have a much more down-to-earth thing. You've got an interesting high-tech car.
Yes, it's already now 7 or 8 years old. But yes, I have a Tesla. Yep.
Yeah, you have an Elon Mobile. Do you have like an actual like key fob to get in, you know, open it and all that, or is it on your
phone? Yes, it's a key fob. It's just proximity, though. There's no, you know, nothing I plug it into. It's just being close by.
Yeah, I've got a normal car, a non-Elon car, but it's fairly modern, and it's got a fob, you know, and you use it, and you could use it. You could actually walk up. You don't have to take it out of your pocket. If you go to open the door and it's in your pocket, it recognizes that you're really close with the key, and it'll unlock for you. But you can do it from a few more feet away by pressing a button. And one of the interesting things about it is that you supposedly, until this week, I thought you could never lock your keys in the car. If you actually left your keys in the car, something my wife would do, because she has a purse, which is separate from her, where I've got a pocket that's not separate from me, she'd get out of the car and it would refuse to lock. And it would actually say on the dash, you could say key, it would say key in car.
Right.
And okay. And even if it's like, even if she left her purse in the car and I got out and tried to lock it with my key on the outside, it would say, nope, key in car. Because obviously it's not really very secure if the key is right there and it could accidentally trigger and let somebody else in. So it seems to be impossible to lock your keys in the car. It's not, though. We found out that it's not. So the situation, which I can tell the story because I know she doesn't listen to this podcast, she left the key in the car because she was just simply getting gas.
Hang on, what's her email address?
Yeah. And she, so there was no reason, she wasn't leaving the car, right? She wasn't even leaving the side because she was getting out of the car, pumping gas, and then she wanted to clean something on the outside of the car. A bird had pooped on the windshield of the car, in the driver's side windshield. And she's like, oh, they've got little rags here. So she grabbed some rags. And then she went over to try to wipe that off, clean it off. In doing so, she had pushed the car door closed. Now, this is something that you and I, as men, may not realize, but women are in their habit of, when they go to a gas station, of locking the car, even if they have the driver's side door open, the idea being not letting the passenger side door be unlocked.
Right.
It's a safety thing, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
So she had done that. She had locked the car, driver's side door open, key in the car, and then had pushed on the door to wipe the window, and unintentionally, the door swung shut. thus locking her out of the car.
Stayed unlocked. Stayed locked. Interesting.
Stayed locked because the doors had been locked, you know, while they were open. And there's her purse in the car with the key. She's outside the car. It will not automatically, you know, the door handle won't open it. Interesting. Unfortunately, this happened when she was 50 miles away up in the mountains.
Dear.
yes. And we only have one car because we live in the city. We don't really need it. So,
right.
So she went and first she was at a gas station, which was fortunate, right? There's people there to help.
Right.
And the people there were very interested in helping. Very nice. They came out. They tried to help. They tried to pop the door open with a little shimmy thing, right. Whatever. Couldn't get it going. This whole thing. And she's trying to figure it all out. And she's like, all right, I'm going to have to call AAA and have them come out and do whatever they can do. But she's then, fortunately, at this point, she realizes the AAA card is in the purse. So she's like, all right, I'm giving up. And she calls me, right? Because it's like, well, at least I can get from Gary the AAA number.
Right.
Right. Or, you know, our membership number.
Right.
She calls me and I was like, oh, wow. And I was like, yeah, this situation, boy, this is a weird situation. I mean, there's nothing I can do. I can't drive up there. We don't have a car, you know, a second car. So then I was like, well, let me look on the AAA app because that's where I'll get the membership number from. And then I was like, well, wait a minute. App. There's an app for the car. Huh. So our car came with an app.
Right.
You would think me, right, or all everything I do and this whole podcast and what we're all about would know all about the app and have used the app in many ways. Not true, since I'm not the primary driver for the car and I rarely drive it.
Mm-hmm.
I never really even bothered to look at the app. I installed it because they do so at the dealership, like while you're sitting there. And then they try to tell you all this crap. You know, with the app, you can tell if the windows are all down and all this stuff. And I'm like, yeah, I know it can do all that. I don't need you telling me. And I just ignored it. And I never used the app the entire time since. Years have passed. I've never used the app. So I was like, well, let me go to the app and let me just see here. Hey, yeah, it says there, car locked. Oh, there's a button here. It says unlock car. I tap it with my finger, fully expecting what error message will this bring up?
Right.
And I tap it and the red button turns to green. And I'm like, try the door. And she's like, it's open. Wow. Okay. First time using it years after buying the car.
Good to know.
And it worked. We didn't pay for any kind of service either. I mean, I thought, well, surely whatever, you know, sample 1 year free service we got has expired. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure I got an email about that, to keep going with
right.
Whatever service it was we needed to pay. And I just ignored it. So apparently that doesn't extend to the car unlocking thing. But it was interesting that this very complex situation had a simple solution. It was just one tap on my phone.
Push a button. Yep.
And it worked remotely. I don't even know. I mean, we're not paying for any kind of mobile service with the car.
Right.
So it's using some back channel, you know, through AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, somebody.
Somebody, yep.
To communicate with the car.
It's funny. Of course, Teslas, you know, all have an app. And I think most people end up using them.
Probably, but, yes.
I've done things like, start the heater before I get in the car on a cold day. Oh, those kinds of things. But I have heard a story where, similar to yours,
yes,
somebody got in his car and drove off, but didn't have his key with him.
Ah.
Apparently it was close enough, you know, to start the car and drive out. And he stopped and he couldn't start the car, which, you know, in the Tesla's case is, you know, turn it on. But he had his phone with him and he fired up the app. And sure enough, that was enough for him to be able to drive his car. The only downside is that if I remember correctly, and this could be just, you know, exaggeration, but if I understand correctly, he was about to drive through a cellular free zone where there was no coverage.
Yeah.
In which case he had to hope that he didn't end up having to stop anywhere that didn't have connectivity, because at that point the app wouldn't have been able to do a thing.
Right.
But yeah, it is kind of interesting. I have, it's funny. I've kind of mixed feelings on the apps. I think they're very, very cool. It's in many cases very useful, as you see. It's a wonderful safety catch, but it's an app. It's another way in. It's another pair of credentials. It's another, piece of vulnerability, if you will. So, like I said, as long as the security is good, it's wonderful. But yeah, so I was just looking at my app while you were talking, and yeah, I can tell you that it's unlocked, the windows are up, it's got 90% charge, it's 63 degrees in the car, so yep, lots of fun.
Cool.
So, it's one of the things that did make the news.
Oh, big time news. For some reason that's puzzling, but yes, huge
Yesterday,
news.
this was just yesterday, the royal family released a picture of the Princess of Wales, who apparently hasn't been seen for some time. And of course, there's all sorts of wonderful conspiracy theories about what's going on. But it didn't take long for people to look closely at the picture and decide, wait a minute, somebody's been photoshopping this, in the sense that, and it was, no AI involved here. We're not even down that path. This is just Photoshop. They looked at here, this was off a little bit, and that didn't line up quite right, and something about this doesn't feel right. So they finally, see, they asked the question, and the royal family pulled the photo. AP actually went so far as to publish a kill order for the photo, that it was not to be used, which is something apparently they rarely, if ever, have done. I just find it fascinating that still, after all this time, that somebody in that public a position releases a photo that just suffers from bad Photoshop. What's funny is that the explanation from the princess herself said something like, "Yeah, I tried to clean it up, and I messed up." And I'm still skeptical about that, because this is the royal family. Do they do their own Photoshop?
I know that question doesn't seem to have been answered exactly who did the Photoshop job and why. It's
I
all
will
things
say, the
very
photo
puzzling.
itself, the kids in the photo, they don't look natural. Their mouths are all wide open, like they're laughing, right? It's almost creepy. But yeah, we'll see if they come up with a replacement photo. They did not offer to share the original, which I also thought was kind of interesting, because if there'd been a call on Photoshop, the first thing I would do in a situation like that was, yep, okay, fine, you caught us. Here's the original. You can see why we did what we did, or why we tried to do what we tried to do. But nope, nothing like that at all. So, yes, in a day of AI, we're still getting tripped up with Photoshop. I just
Well,
thought that.
or not really that much in that case, because I mean, it didn't really stand up very long to
Yeah.
scrutiny.
True. Yes. Well, they're still trying to use Photoshop. But yes. Yeah.
I guess the only reason it ever got published in the first place was because it was so bizarre to like it's just a normal photo. I mean, there's nothing special about it.
Right.
So it what nobody was on high alert. It wasn't like here's like two world leaders shaking hands at a secret meeting, and oh, we need to examine this photo. This is just like, oh, it's just a family photo. It's like there was no real reason for people to be suspicious
It's weird.
until somebody noticed, and then now everybody has these wild conspiracy theories.
Well, I think they actually did have reason to be suspicious beforehand, because she has still not been seen publicly, and there's concern that there's something else going on. And so it doesn't surprise me in the least that after being out of the public eye, just having this random photo show up, that subset of folks would at least, check its veracity. And it looks like they stumbled onto something.
We're all so busy worried about AI doing this at an advanced level that they at first missed a very amateur,
Exactly.
regular, could have been done 20 years ago Photoshop job.
So either Kate needs to brush up on her Photoshop skills, or somebody needs to get fired.
Somebody needs to get fired. But then again, you know, so let's say this was like a, I don't know, somebody working in the office, on her office or their sure. office. Something tells me it's like, okay, if you're a really good Photoshop expert, you don't start looking for jobs in that sector. Like, you probably want to work in graphic arts, right? You probably actually want to, like, use your skills. Like, you don't just go and say, well, what I really want to do is a job that probably 99% of the time doesn't involve me using Photoshop.
Right.
But every once in a while, somebody's going to ask me to do something like this.
Yeah.
So that's why you end up, I think, with things like this, is because, yeah, you don't have a Photoshop expert there just waiting for their opportunity once a year to, like, doctor a tiny photo, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In other news,
yeah.
this is a story that actually a couple of the cybersecurity or AI, no, it was the AI, one of the AI podcasts was talking about. It's called The Young Indian Method Teaches TikTok Spammers How to Hire and Control Third World Country Workers.
Yeah.
So what they're doing, what's happening apparently, is that there's a set of TikTokers that are basically showing other people how to use AI to basically make TikTok spam, is what you would call it.
Yeah.
There's various techniques. You get some video, you get some random data, you throw it over there, you use AI generated voices, all that kind of stuff, to the point where the whole process is pretty much automated. That's not what caught my attention. That doesn't surprise me. What caught my attention is that they are surprised that people are outsourcing this, that people are doing this overseas. I go all the way back to the 4-hour work week, which was 20 years ago now, where, you know, one of the fundamental principles of creating yourself a 4-hour work week was to outsource as much of your non-creative work overseas. In fact, the example virtual assistant that he was using at the time was somebody in India, now a location that we consider to be, you know, one of the places where you find a lot of these people for cheap. I'm just surprised, like I said, that anybody thinks that aspect of it is what is new. To me, the interesting part is the AI usage and so forth, and that doesn't surprise me because it just sort of feels inevitable. But yeah, the fact that it's, you know, young Indian method, we've been using the young Indian method for decades.
Yeah, it's a, so 2007 was actually when the 4-hour work week was published.
Okay, I wasn't that far off.
And it is interesting because it was a bit of a sensation when it came out.
Yes.
I remember I read it, of course, and I remember not liking it in some ways. In other ways, there were things I was doing. but not necessarily, you know, well, the two things I didn't like about it was, first is the assumption is made throughout the book that what you really want to do as the reader is travel. And that's actually kind of true in my case. But
right.
I kind of rebelled against the idea that not everybody, you know, not everybody wants to travel. Some people may want to do these techniques and not go anywhere.
Right.
You know, it's not, it seemed like the author, Tim Ferriss, was a little bit blinded by, like, well, I want to travel, so that therefore everybody must want to travel. The other thing about it was the assumption that you don't want to work, you want to work as little as possible. And I was like, well, maybe you, but if you find something you really like doing,
right.
The goal is not to do it for 4 hours. Like, I really do like coding, and it's hard, you know, the type of stuff I like to code. I mean, I have my fun apps now. I've got my games I did in the past. I really didn't mind coding. I would, if I could cut down to doing coding for 4 hours a week, I would have been unhappy. Like, I would have wanted to code. I would have been like, great, I have all this spare time. What should I do? I'll code more. You know, so there was this whole feeling that, you know, it's like, you don't want to work. Like, work is miserable for everybody all the time, no matter what you do. And it's like, nah, not necessarily. A lot of people enjoy what they do, whether it's the actual work itself or the results or whatever. But it is interesting to think of how it's changed, because it was in 2007 was before the creator economy.
Yes.
That we have now. So work always meant working for somebody else. And I remember him talking in the book about, like, putting these hours in for somebody remotely, right? The idea is, you know, VPN, and you log in remotely, you know, so you're in Madrid, you know, having a great time, and your boss doesn't know that because the company's in Texas or whatever,
right?
You know, and but now the creator economy changes things because you could be traveling, be wherever you want, but you don't have a boss somewhere else. You're creating, whether it's YouTube videos, whether it's apps, right? I mean, 2007 was just before mobile apps,
Right.
and just before YouTube, you know, creators, and just before a lot of different things, certainly Patreon and all of the different types of things like that. So yeah, interesting that how things have changed a lot since
like you, I read it, of course, what it's not long after it came out. Mm-hmm. And my approach, you know, I started looking for a virtual assistant, for example, and I have one. In fact, I have the same one. Mm-hmm. But my lesson was more about, and I think it's along the lines of what you were saying. There's stuff I like to do about my business and stuff I don't like to do about my business. There's stuff that I enjoy and would spend hours doing. There's stuff that I tolerate, but that's very time consuming if I do them. You know, it keeps me away from, say, answering questions or doing whatever it is. So I absolutely did learn the outsourcing lesson. I think that that's an important one. My reaction to is outsourcing to cheaper countries was a little bit more iffy, right? I didn't go that route. You know, my VA is in the middle of the United States. My editor is like 50 miles north of me. You know, a couple of my other folks are in, one's in Idaho and the other one's in Germany, of all places. You know, so I didn't go that route, but I definitely tried to learn the lesson of, okay, what's important that I do and what kinds of things can I hand off? What does it make sense to hand off? And that was good. What I also thought was interesting in recent years, I don't know how long ago I heard this, but Ferris, I don't know if he either admitted or came to the conclusion that it's not 4 hours.
Yeah.
Right? It's not like, you know, he created himself a 4-hour work week. That was basically a title to get people's attention. And of course it did, to be fair. But ultimately, I think that the real success there was getting people to think in other ways. I just, you know, like I said, I am surprised that people are surprised that that technique is being used for, you know, things like flooding TikTok with AI-generated spam, which is apparently getting revenue just because of the algorithm, right? The spam is stuff that people are actually looking at. And it's built mostly on the theft of other creators' videos.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. And I mean, AI's got a lot of that going on. I think AI really does. It's another change, yet, you know, from 2007, you know,
right.
Creators, creation economy, you know, is a big one. And, but then also, you know, AI now maybe being in another change that I think it hasn't solidified yet. Like, we're still at the very beginning here.
Right.
I actually tried this week to do something. So not necessarily taking away something I was doing manually.
Right.
But I've always wanted to actually teach people about, like, how to protect themselves against scams, online scams.
Right.
And I do that with my regular videos sometimes, and I can write about it. But what I really think would be compelling is like a kind of a comic book or graphic novel style way of teaching about
Okay.
it.
Yeah.
But I can't draw.
Oh,
And
right.
And it's always, every time I've thought of like how I could do this, it's a big project. And so I'd either have to like pay a good artist a lot of money to actually do a good job of, like, you know, creating something like that, or I'd have to learn how to draw myself or something like that, but I'm never good enough. I thought, well, AI may be the answer, but not yet. I actually tried like feeding it a really good description of exactly like what I wanted to say and have it draw a comic for me. And the funny thing is, if I hit the prompt and it's a long prompt, and I hit return and I move my chair back from the computer and watch the page that comes up,
right,
the first impression is it did it.
Of course.
And then if I move closer, I see that the words are nonsense words.
Yes.
And even the words that should be obvious, like, you know, like the word scam is spelled like wrong or something. And it's just nonsense words with nonsense bubbles, but it all looks kind of like you know, from afar, if I held it across the room and said, here's my page that explains how this type of scam works, you'd be, oh, okay. You know, not until you saw it closely that it's like, well, maybe if it was drawn by an insane person, you know. So it's very weird, but it did actually have a character that ran throughout, and it did actually seem to just, the basics were there. And it occurred to me, oh, I think I need an in-between kind of thing. If I want to do this kind of work, like I can't draw, so let's create a comic. I think I would have to go and do it in smaller pieces, like go panel to panel and just describe just a character and some objects and some things, not give it a, here's what I want, do the whole thing. But just, you know, I was giving it too big of an overview. And the thing is, I think I could probably do it if I was patient enough in a few hours. And then it occurred to me that, well, if I could draw, it would probably take me at least a few hours to draw this. So maybe it has actually leveled the playing field as far as some skills are concerned.
Right.
Because if, and I bet you I'd get better at it. I bet you maybe it would take me all day to
you
just
should,
get it to do one page. You know?
You should talk to Connie, actually, our lovely editor. She's actually published a book this way.
Oh, okay.
It's a kid's book, so it's got some, you know, cartoon
touch. Right, sure. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'd have to, I'd really need to break it down. But it is interesting because before it would have been impossible for me to do it on my own.
I would have
had to hire somebody. And now there's a little bit of like hope that maybe I could actually do this using AI tools. Maybe it's like I need to wait a few more months, 6 months, a year for the tools to get a tiny bit better and then my skills to get better. And then, I don't know. But it is interesting. And it does go way back into the whole like 4-hour work week. How do we... How can you apply those same ideas, maybe not to work less, but to actually expand what you do? Certainly people that don't know. Yeah. Certainly people don't know how to code have been using it to get a little bit of coding done. So
the thing that I've become somewhat proficient in, because as you know, I use AI images for a lot of, for Ask Leo articles these days and for 7 Takeaways.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right. AI right now is horrible with text. It's so bizarre. I have no idea what kind of quote unquote thinking goes into what it produces. But what I've gotten good at is taking the AI generated image into Photoshop and cleaning it up.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, the part where I fall down is creativity, like the AI just generates ideas for me that I never would have thought of on my own. And then it turns those ideas into something concrete, digitally concrete.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. There's these you know, rough edges, and at least things like removing text or replacing text with what you really intended to say, that's easy to do in something like Photoshop. So I've gone down that path myself a few times. But you're right. Someday, hopefully it will get better and more interestingly intelligent about that.
Yep.
So how's it going? How's the Apple Vision Pro? It's, you've had it, what, a month now?
Oh, well, more. February 2nd, Groundhog Day, was the day I got it. And so, an update. I have edited every video since February 2nd using Apple Vision Pro.
Wow.
I'm not actually, there's no app in Apple Vision Pro. I'm using my Mac, but I'm using it as a screen.
Right.
And it is, I can't film the video with it. You have to see my face and all that. But as soon as I'm done filming, I go grab the headset. I put it on. I view my Mac on a massive screen in front of me. That's a massive screen that actually looks like it's in the middle of the room. So it's just a wonderful level for working with video editing, I think. I haven't been hurt by the fact that it's only one screen because it's a big screen. So I find that I don't even want my video editor to take up the whole screen. It takes up probably half the screens with the bottom right corner being down there, right? So I have some room on the left, room on the top, finder windows, text files, graphics, things like that are around there. I edit. I don't know if I'm saving any time because I'm probably doing a little bit more with it. You know, you fill the time with like, oh, now I can do a little more with these graphics because the screen is so nice and big and it's easy to work with. but it certainly feels better for my eyes, like doing it that way. It does really feel like the screen is big in the middle of the room, for my eyes. Like my eyes don't get strained, like staring at a smaller screen in front of me for a long period of time, which is nice. I continue then when I'm done editing the video. I usually do all my little tasks, like writing video descriptions, creating thumbnails, uploading, you know, all that stuff. I do still wearing it, and then basically. I have to, you know, it's time for lunch at that point, and I got to remember to take it off. There have been a couple times where I've started to stand up and realize, oh no, I can't walk away from my desk. I'm attached with a cable.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Are you using a virtual keyboard or a real keyboard mouse?
No, I'm using, so when you do the Mac screen thing, I'm still using the same keyboard and trackpad that I normally am. So that's all just here. And I'm, you know, so everything else was kind of normal. It's just a really big screen. If occasionally I do get a message or something, I will look at it in a separate window that's a Vision Pro window. But usually I'm pretty focused. I have discovered that it has been great for focus because I'm putting the thing on. So it's not easy to – it's actually extremely easy to take off. Like I could just grab it and take it off in like a second and be like – ready to, you know, move away from my desk if I want to. Putting it back on, though, I have to put it back on and then go to the controls and say, mirror my Mac screen and all of that. So I don't want to take it off easily. Like if I have a water bottle near me and I feel around for it because I can't see, you know, off in that corner of my desk, I want to try to grab the water bottle without being able to see it. Because if I have to take the headset off to grab the water bottle and take a drink, well, now that was quick and easy. But now it's going to take me 10, 15 seconds to get the Mac screen back up. So I try to keep it on, which means I tend to really focus on working. I'm not distracted by the pretty sky outside my window. Right. I'm not distracted by all the little gadgets and books and things that are in my office. I'm not distracted by those. It's a really nice focus tool. So that's been a benefit I didn't expect. And it's got really nothing to do with all the technology. It's just kind of a side benefit. Then I come back from lunch and I put it back on. And I code in it. I work on my Clip Tools app, work on some other little projects. Nice big screen. It's beautiful, big to work, you know, to work on and all. Playing around with some other things, reading articles, just, you know, I tend to, it depends on what I'm doing. If I'm doing something where I need to leave my desk and come back often, then I just tend to use my screen, the regular screen. If I know I'm like sitting down for any period of time, the Vision Pro goes on and I kind of miss it when I'm not using it. Looking at the screen, my regular screen seems so small in comparison.
Right.
Also, now watching TV and movies has been fantastic.
Yeah, you mentioned that before. We were talking about what was it? One of the movies that was available in an extremely high resolution that you could now actually.
Yeah, Hateful Eight. Yeah. That. But also, you know, just regular watching some TV shows. Obviously, when my wife and I are watching something, I'm not using it. We're watching together on a TV. But if it's something I'm watching on my own, I will watch it completely inside. So watch like the whole Masters of the Air series on Apple TV Plus. It looked fantastic. It's just a regular 2D, you know, TV series, but it looked fantastic in them. Watched all of some of the Oscar nominees, like Poor Things. I watched all of Poor Things in it, which turned out to be great because, you know, the scenery and the weird steampunk universe.
Yeah, we may talk about that.
We may, and lots of other stuff like that. So I love watching TV and movies. I cannot wait for baseball season to start because I want to see what it's like to watch a baseball game. It's the only sport I'm really interested in. So I'm a couple weeks away from getting to see what sports will be like. And really enjoying it, really liking it, getting a ton of use out of it, not having any side effects. I am susceptible to headaches. I'm a headache sufferer, as you know, I would say. But I've not noticed any problem with it. As a matter of fact, I may be tempted to say I get less headaches because of it. I don't know. Maybe it's because of the eye strain. I don't know. But it certainly does not seem to be causing me any difficulty there. And also, I don't have any problems. I'll take it off and walk away immediately. So I thought with VR goggles and stuff that you would, maybe have some issues with that.
Right,
But no,
adjustment.
I'll take it off as I'm standing up, take them off and walk right out of my office and not even think about it till later that I did that. And I was like, yeah, I guess there really isn't any issues with that. So
Interesting.
I know different people have different experiences with it. Online, there are a lot of people saying different things. A lot of people saying what I'm saying. Some
Right.
people not, saying the opposite, some of whom don't actually use it. But there are people that do use it and say, that's, they've had issues, but again, it's a different type of thing. I mean, there are people that have issues using computer screens,
Oh, yeah, of course. But like you might have guessed, I ran into a couple of those brief comments where people were saying that they didn't use it, or that it just was, they hadn't picked it up in a month or something like that. So it made me wonder where you were at on that spectrum. And clearly you're at the far end, which is
Yeah,
great.
I am a fan. I mean, it is my favorite Apple product for a long time. I'm considering, the Mac's nothing new, so I, love the Macs I have now, but they're just continuations of a long product line. But I am just shocked. I really did think that I would be like playing with it for a couple weeks, and then it would kind of sit by the wayside. I
Right.
really wish more stuff would come out for it. Like, there's not too much in terms of new content. Apple hasn't really come out with any new content like that's immersive since the beginning. And there haven't really been any real games. I mean, there's a couple casual games you could play and stuff, but the potential for like having fully immersive VR games that work in this is there. It's completely there. Yet there's nothing available.
Right.
So that's very frustrating, knowing that there are games out there that play in VR that are fully 3D that could actually be, distributed in such a way that you could play it on this. It's kind of like, oh, come on. I want to see that. Or, and even the 3D content, like it all takes is, two cameras, really, a camera rig that's got two cameras in it. And it kind of bugs me that Apple isn't doing more. Like, why wasn't Apple at the Academy Awards
Oh,
with one
yeah.
of these cameras?
Yeah.
Just put three of them just around and say, we'll do this and it'll be a special thing. Or why doesn't Apple have some agreement with some, I don't know, just something, just get something out there that's more, it doesn't have to be amazing. Just give me some drone footage. Give me a drone shot of the day in immersive video.
Do you remember there were books called Over Washington, Over, I'm sure there was an Over Colorado, that kind of stuff. It was basically photographs of, and it may have been actually some videos at the time too, where they would fly over some of the beautiful areas in our
Yeah.
country. And that seems like a wonderful opportunity for something exactly like that.
Just I don't know. It just seems like Apple's put so much money into developing it, and they put a ton of money into marketing it for the launch. It's like, just throw us one little piece of content. Just doesn't even have to be, I don't, I guess they may be too focused on, oh, it's got to be perfect, right? We're gonna make another 15-minute episode of the animal thing. But it's got to be really well done.
Right.
Whereas I would almost just wish that they would just go to the San Jose Zoo and just go in and, have put a camera in with the tigers and get 10 minutes of footage and just like give us that as like a fun thing on one day. And then another day it's a drone shot. And another day it's somebody scuba diving with one of these cameras. I don't know. It just would be. It's like there's so many possibilities. I'm excited for that. Even the games, it's like, all right, so maybe not a fully immersive 3D, environment, huge, massive AAA game. Give us something. I mean, I've been tempted to actually play around. I have played around a little bit with development to be like, oh, it'd just be fun just to have, like, I don't know, it's just a fish tank all around you and you try to,
If
tap on the fish. I don't, something like that.
you want to get some notoriety, I know exactly what you need to do.
Yeah.
I believe it's open source now. Get Doom running on it.
Yeah. Exactly. There you go.
That would get you a hell of a lot of publicity.
Why not? I see YouTube videos of people saying we've gotten doomed to run on some sort of like cheap, you know, $30 watch. Or well, doomed.
They had it running on a toothbrush.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So just get it right. Yeah. Give me that as an app. There you go. I'll pay $10. I'll pay $20 right now to put the original Doom, just like it looked before, all retro, but it's 3D. And I could just, you know, use it with a game controller or a keyboard or whatever. So all this stuff's so possible that I just have to think it's just, okay, just be patient. Just be patient. There'll be things coming out in the next weeks, months on this. If I was a game development studio, I think I said this before. If I was a game development studio that I was looking at a title that was like, we're not getting the attention that everybody else is getting. Like, we got this thing coming out and we think it's really cool, but it's just not going to be, you know, the top game on whatever platform. Switch to the Apple Vision Pro, you know, compile it for that, get it working on that. And you could get a ton of publicity just releasing your 3D immersive game. You know, I don't know. So I'm excited. I'm a huge fanboy, and I just hope we see more content come out of it. Until then, I'm happy just getting work done on it.
Cool. That's very cool. I'm glad to hear that it's working out that well for you. Yeah. I have another question for you.
Yeah.
Do you use Git?
No, I don't.
Okay. Git, for our listener who may not know, is essentially a place you can store your source code. It's intended for team development. So there's ways to share the source code, merge changes to the source code, track the history of the source code, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I use something similar myself, but it's hosted on Amazon Web Services. Anyway, one of the things that has happened over the last couple of years is that people have noticed that some developers are kind of prone to hard coding secrets in their source code. Secrets could be any number of different things. The most obvious case, and I know I've been guilty of this in the past, is to hard code a password, right? Your script, your program needs to connect to a remote resource. It needs a username and password for that. So you hard code the username and password into your code because you can get it done quickly, and then you forget to clean it up.
Sure, yeah.
Friend of the show, Greg Bulmash, who I believe was actually a guest on the show some years ago, shared with me something called the State of Secrets Sprawl. It's essentially a review of the secrets that are routinely exposed in Git repositories. And I think it's fascinating. Most of the secrets are not necessarily passwords. They're things like private keys, which is even scarier. But it's like rampant. And the company he works for, they have services where they will go out and scan the publicly accessible Git repositories and identify any secrets therein. So anyway, I just thought that was a really, really interesting thing. It's one of the many different causes of some of the breaches we hear about from time to time. And I just thought it was an interesting way of, you know, some actual mitigation against this kind of stuff happening in the future. So anyway, just thought that was interesting and wanted to share what Greg had shared with me.
Cool.
Ain't it cool? What's cool this week, Gary?
Well, this is an extremely on topic. Ain't it cool? instead of a sci-fi book or cool movie or whatever, I read a book I'm sure you've heard of, the Kara Swisher book, Burn Book, that came out 2 weeks ago.
I don't think I've heard of it. No.
Oh, okay. Well, boy, stuff I follow, it's all over the place. Okay. So Kara Swisher is one of the most famous tech journalists of all time.
Mm-hmm.
She started covering the tech industry pre-internet days for newspapers like the Wall Street Journal and Washington Post. Went on, you know, to have Wall Street Journal sponsored things like All Things Digital and Recode and all of that. And, you know, holding forums, doing interviews, very famous for doing, you know, interviews, not only with Steve Jobs, but also for bringing Steve Jobs and Bill Gates together. for a famous interview. And she's basically interviewed and scooped, like, for 2-3 decades, the tech industry, right? So she knows all of the big names for the whole history of the tech industry, and is definitely one of the most well-respected journalists. And she wrote, finally put this all together, like a memoir type of book about her life, covering all of these people from the early 90s to today. And it's fascinating to hear the behind-the-scenes story. Basically, it's behind-the-scenes story of all these news scoops. You know, when big events have happened, we've read about them. A lot of times they've come from her reporting, even if you've been reading them at another source. The original reporting was done by her. Yeah. And then you find out the big headlines and the story. And then now we get to hear the, how did you find that out? What was the interview like? What did the person who she scooped, you know, really, how do they feel about that?
Right.
That kind of thing. And her opinions basically on how these people really were, you know? So you hear basically more or less how horrible most of the tech billionaires actually were. One of the themes that goes through it, though, is that very few of them started out horrible. It seems like money made them horrible.
Which is kind of sad when you think about it. I think we all like to think of ourselves as, you know, whoever we are today, we would be the same if we had a billion extra dollars. And apparently that's not necessarily.
Yeah. Maybe not. It seems like our current favorite horrible billionaire, Elon Musk, is not alone. Like, this story has been repeated over and over again. And with a lot of these people, even going back to some of the people from the 90s, you know, almost pre-internet, you know, talking about like AOL and Netscape and all those early tech billionaires. But she did have some nice things to say about some people. It seems like she liked Steve Jobs. She liked Mark Cuban, you know, mostly nice things to say about them. Other people, you know, became horrible after a while. And you hear a lot about it. There's a lot about sexism, of course, being a female reporter, you know, in the industry, she experienced it. But also, of course, she's reporting on guys, all guys. It's like almost all the CEOs, almost all these people were white men, right? So, and then attempts to get women into, you know, positions and stuff sometimes were laughable. And there were a lot of issues that went on, a lot of boys club type issues that were really bad. And then she didn't necessarily have the stories to report it then, because she was reporting on like the actual like financial stuff and new inventions and all that. But in this book, she can go back and look at it and say like how bad some of this stuff was. So it's a fascinating read because it's retelling a lot of these stories I've heard from the kind of rah-rah type of storytelling, you know, the rise of Apple, the rise of Microsoft, the rise of Netscape and AOL and, you know, all this stuff. And it's all to be like, you know, get you enthusiastic about like, you know, this group of people, this one person, you know, turn this idea into this huge thing. And to go back and then hear like how basically a lot of the stuff made the world worse, not better. It's really fascinating. So if you like tech history,
I'm gonna have to check it out.
I think you should definitely check it out. There's plenty in there about Microsoft and a lot. I mean, everything from that era all the way up to like stuff that happened all the way up to like, you know, OpenAI in the last year, you know?
Cool. Yeah. So you kind of broke my Ain't It Cool earlier.
Well, I didn't break. I didn't say it was cool. I just said I watched it.
You scooped me. So yes, mine, of course, is Poor Things, which we actually watched last night. Kind of on a, you know, obviously Emma Stone had won Best Actress the night before. Uh-huh. And we were kind of thinking, well, you know, okay, let's, it looks weird. Let's risk it. And we were absolutely fascinated by this movie. At the end of it, we loved it, both of us. Mm-hmm. And as you pointed out, it's got kind of a steampunky vibe to it.
Yeah.
Although that's not, it's not, it's the environment, but it's not the story.
Yeah.
The story is a little bit more, I don't know, Frankenstein crossed with Isle of Dr. Moreau or something, but
yeah.
It's a fascinating, fascinating movie. The and I absolutely understand why Emma Stone deserved that Oscar. Her performance in this, the if I call it wide ranging, that's an understatement. Because the way that her character transforms is, I'm sure, an absolute challenge for any actor. So anyway, we loved it. We recommend it. I will say that if you are squeamish, may not be for you. And if you are easily offended by sex scenes, then this may not be for you. But if those, I mean, they're not gratuitous in any sense of the word. They are, you know, they are part of the story, but they are included in the story. So anyway, yeah, four things. I liked it. And it sounds like you did too.
Yeah, yeah, I liked it. I found it was interesting. And I think actually not only did Emma Stone star in it, I think she was one of the driving forces behind getting the movie made as well. So yeah. Cool. Yeah. Cool. All right. Anyway. So self-promotion.
Yep.
What do you got?
Oh, okay. So we talked about this earlier. I put together a video and an article that are walking through how I use AI at Ask Leo. This is not, you know, pie in the sky. Wouldn't it be nice if? This is very practical, very pragmatic approaches that, like I mentioned earlier, I'm not particularly creative. ChatGPT is more creative at generating ideas for me. It's a better artist than I am. I'm still a better writer. I am still, and I know my subject, so I'm not having it write anything for me, but I'm absolutely having it do things like summarize that I would then translate into my writing as opposed to its writing. I had it in one example. I was answering a question from a reader and I had written my article and I'd come up with like 4 points, I think it is, that they needed to look into. And then just for the fun of it, I asked ChatGPT the same question and it came up with my four ideas, which is always, you know, reassuring, plus two more, which I hadn't thought of. So it's also another case of okay, this is another great way to use it. It's not doing the work for me, but it is definitely helping me be more complete and do things more efficiently. The characterization that I use at the beginning of it is the is that it's a very fast but untrustworthy intern. And I do want to point out that the article and the companion video, while they cover the same topic, they do it on two different articles. In other words, in the video, I walk through how I actually created an article. And in the article, I walk through how I created a different article. So both of them are actually kind of interesting in how they turned out. That is, how I use AI at Ask Leo. It's askleo.com/168449.
Cool. I did a video this week in response to a few questions I had gotten over a few months about using a green screen. Old-fashioned technique, you can use a green screen in a variety of different ways with your computer, but I had a lot of people that seemed to think it was some sort of magical technology, that it was beyond them, and that green screen, I even had somebody comment that they couldn't afford to get a green screen, which I was like, what? It's just anything green, you know? So I did a video not only showing how you could pretty almost for nothing have a green screen behind you, but how it's not just useful in, like, say, creating a video like an iMovie, but many apps like Zoom allow you to use a green screen to produce better quality video in your meetings. So, you know, because you don't have to use a green screen with Zoom. You could just have it take the background out. But if you wave your hand really fast, you could really see that, you know, it's trying to figure out what's the foreground and the background. Whereas if you use a green screen with Zoom, it goes to a totally different type of processing. And so there are various different ways that you could use a green screen with your Mac. And it really is almost free kind of thing. I mean, you can get like a sheet or a piece of poster board for $10 if you just want something simple. And I go through some of the ways to use it. Basically, I demystify that green screen is anything special, that you really need any special skills or equipment to use.
It's funny. My original green screen was quite literally that. It's funny. I ordered it.
Yeah.
You know, green fabric on Amazon. And what shows up? A sheet. It is literally a green bed sheet.
Yeah.
And I've since moved on from that because I have something that I can easily collapse to, you know, to get access to what's normally behind me. But yeah, as you know, I use it quite a bit and it's a lot of fun.
Cool.
So that, I think, wraps us up for yet another week. As always, thanks everyone for listening, and we will see you here again real soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at thpodcast.com, TEH217. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.